Hello, and welcome to The Real, the podcast where culture and entertainment meet. I'm your host, Mark Olson. On today's episode,
I do think this is the best, smartest, most confidently radical Hollywood studio treatment of a literary adaptation I've seen in quite some time. Something that's just such as beloved a touchstone as Little Women is, it's like that's actually pretty radical.
That's coming up later in the show. But first, I'm back again with entertainment business reporter Ryan Fonder. Ryan, thanks so much for being back with us.
Good to be here.
As people are hearing this, the Sundance Film Festival will be in its early days, just having started its 2020 edition. And I'm going to be there in Park City covering the movie along with some of our colleagues. And Ryan, you and I have just collaborated on a story together kind of about the business of Sundance. I mean, the kind of wheeling and dealing is always a big part of the conversation around it. So give us some sense of what kind of the business picture for Sundance in 2020 looks like.
Well, when you talk to people who plan on being there doing the buying and selling, a lot of what you hear is comparisons to last year when it seemed like there was a bit of a feeding frenzy, especially with Amazon coming in, trying to make a statement, buying up a whole bunch of movies like Britney Runs a Marathon and Late Night, spending $13 million, $14 million for the rights to release each of these movies. This year, since a lot of those movies didn't do so great when they actually came out in theaters, people are looking at that and saying, well, maybe some of these distributors will be exercising a little bit more caution.
And are there any new players coming in this year? I mean, I know over the last few years, that's kind of been what's driving the market, is it seems like every year there's been someone new trying to make a big statement. Are there some expected new players again this year?
I think so. Probably not to the level of last year. I mean, Amazon was really the big, like, whoa, like this is a company that is really trying to say something with its pocketbook. But this year, you do have HBO Max, which is not a new player because, I mean, Warner Media and Warner Brothers have been in it for a long time. But they're going to be looking to fill a pipeline for their streaming service to compete with Disney. So movies can help with that.
And for listeners who maybe don't entirely understand the process, how does this work? Like when, you know, producers, sales agents, they're kind of like bringing their wares to market. What's kind of the exchange, the dynamic like between sort of sellers and then distributors, between sellers and buyers?
You get the sales agents, which are part of larger agencies and other companies like UTA, who are coming with movies that they're representing. They're coming on behalf of the filmmakers, so the producers. So they're mostly trying to get like the best deal for their clients. So what you'll see is these agents coming in and trying to start a bidding war, start to try to play studios off of each other so that they get a bigger price. And that's kind of what happened last year with The Farewell, even though the producer ended up going with a lower offer because they wanted to be in traditional theaters rather than just on a streaming service.
How have streaming services changed the dynamic of Sundance? I think especially, you know, we see a company like Netflix is coming in this year. I think they have 10 titles they're bringing into the festival. Whether or not they acquire anything at the festival will still remain to be seen. Is there some change, whether it's in box office numbers, however people are figuring streaming metrics, like how has sort of like the dynamic changed for distributors?
One thing that people blame Netflix for is really bidding up the price of these acquisitions. See movies going for $13, $14 million that previously probably would have gone for $5 or $6. So that's a big change. But people have been overpaying for movies at Sundance for decades. You know, this is sort of part of the Sundance lore, I think, is having these movies that generate a lot of excitement in thin air of Utah mountains and end up completely wiping out when they actually go before a general audience.
I have attended the festival quite a few times now. And as you and I were collaborating on this story together, you a couple times said to me that to you, you know, Park City might as well be Narnia. It's right. Like this place that you've heard about, but you've never really been to. So do you have any questions for me?
Is there a sense of the hype and the frothiness around these deals? Like, does it change year to year?
Well, I think you know in advance what the buzzy titles are going to be. And part of the reason why this year in particular the fact that so many of what feel like the hot movies have distribution already, it's going to be interesting to see if that sort of changes the level of excitement in the room. Because a lot of times in past years, when a movie's had distribution, even though it's got stars, seems exciting, the air seems out of the room a little bit because the big excitement of like, is there going to be a big sale? Like, is sort of taken off the table. And so I think this year, when there are movies that are on the table that are going to be an acquisition, you know, expected to be a big acquisitions title, I would imagine the hype around them is going to be even more exciting, kind of like a rock concert expectation before the movie starts. And then when it's over and there's lots of applause and ovations and the filmmakers are on stage, it just feels really exciting. And then especially when the news starts to come out of like, oh, this is in play, or oh, did you hear about this big deal? Then the next screening, people want to go to that because they want to say they were there the year that, you know, Little Miss Sunshine sold, and so, or whatever the movie is. It becomes a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it just becomes this perpetual motion machine of like people being excited and wanting to be in those rooms.
Yeah. I mean, when I think of festivals, I think of a lot of like industry people showing up and them largely having the same kind of crowd, like really sophisticated sort of film nerd, film Twitter type of people coming in. But doesn't Sundance have this sort of different dynamic where you get a lot of locals?
There's the industry crowd. There is sort of a film intelligentsia crowd of people who are maybe industry affiliated and they've still come to Park City to see these movies, or people who are just real film fans and like want to be there for this excitement. And then there's the sort of local crowd.
Right.
And I think that probably is a great way for us to wrap up. And listeners can find our full Sundance coverage in the print edition of the LA Times or online at latimes.com. Thanks so much for joining us.
See you next time.
And now, it's time for Glenn Whip's Awards Minute.
The Oscars are 2 weeks away. And Saturday night, the Directors Guild will host their annual award show. And the big showdown here is between, as it is in the Best Picture race, Sam Mendes for 1917, Bong Joon-ho for Parasite. It's the one Oscar race we're still kind of looking at because we know that Joaquin Phoenix, Renee Zellweger, Laura Dern, and Brad Pitt are winning the acting races. So what's up with director? What's up with picture? If Bong Joon-ho wins director at the Directors Guild, does that mean Parasite could possibly become the first foreign language film to win the Best Picture Oscar? It's going to be intense Saturday night looking at that ceremony. Maybe the short films, there's a little intrigue there, but I don't think anyone's really paying attention to that. But director, picture, we're going to know a little bit more Saturday night.
Thank you, Glenn. And thanks for sticking around for today's panel. We're joined now by Jen Yamato and Justin Chang. Thanks, everyone, for being here.
Thanks for having us here, Mark Olson.
And I wanted to take a few minutes today to talk about a few movies that we actually haven't really had a chance to dive into here. The Irishman, Little Women, and 1917. These are three of sort of the last movies to kind of enter the awards race. They, I think, all have, you know, made an impact in their own way. And so I want to be sure that we get a chance to sort of like hash it out a little bit. And maybe we'll start with The Irishman, which is, of course, Martin Scorsese's 3.5 hour long crime drama on Netflix, starring Robert De Niro, Al Pacino, and Joe Pesci. Glenn, there was an ad for The Irishman that ran on last year's Oscars broadcast. Like Netflix ran a TV ad for The Irishman. So this is kind of, this movie's had a certain feeling of inevitability about it. Like you knew this was coming for over a year, for, you know, for the better part of a year now. How do you feel about that? Like, do you feel like a movie like this that really came in, you know, with all this momentum and portent, what did that mean to you when we finally actually got the movie?
Yeah, they planted that flag a year ago. I was hearing around Telluride that Marriage Story was going to be Netflix's big bet on the Best Picture race. And it ended up kind of being The Irishman. The Irishman earned more nominations than Marriage Story. Neither one is going to win. And I'm starting to wonder, is Netflix ever going to win Best Picture? Because what I felt like last year with Green Book and Roma, you were hearing just the people talking, whispering, you know, not voting for Netflix, it's not really a movie. This is just something you watch on your TV. And I was like, eh. But then I keep hearing it, you know? I keep hearing
people. You hear
people
saying that about The Irishman and Marriage Story?
Yeah. More about The Irishman, because Marriage Story isn't really being talked about as much. Yeah, how many viewings did it take you to make it through The Irishman on Netflix?
So if it was like a clean 2 hours long, you think it would have played better and people would have seen it more as a movie?
I don't know. I think people's attention spans have been ruined.
But Justin, how do you feel about that? Do you think that it matters, the fact that the movie is as long as it is, and that it, whether or not it's impacted, whether people even try to see it?
I definitely do. Friends of mine have said things similar. They're not members of the Academy, but just people watching The Irishman. Oh, yeah, that took me a while to get through. And
they're still your friends, Justin?
They are. It's okay. Look, you know, I mean, I love the movie, and I get it, because it's, you know, what if you chopped this up the way Netflix does sometimes, and, you know, and they did with Hateful Eight or something? What if they chopped it up into pieces so that it was a limited series or miniseries kind of presentation? But the pacing and the rhythm of the movie are very cinematic, and it is designed for a theater. I saw the movie twice in theaters, and it was a long time. But I actually think, you know, when you give a movie your full attention and you let it cast a spell, those things sort of fade away. And so I didn't find, you know, and the movie is, you know, it has its longers, it has its, you know, its hiccups, perhaps. I don't even think they're hiccups. I just think that the movie is so big and encompassing so much in terms of time and in terms of just, it meanders in a great way, I think. And then it becomes completely gripping, I think, in that third hour. But I think it has a unique pacing and rhythm to it that if you are watching semi-distractedly, as we all watch a lot of things on streaming nowadays, it's like you run that risk.
Well, I do enjoy, there's a moment in the movie where there's a framing story to the entire movie. The majority of the movie is being told from sort of like a single flashback. There's a flashback within that sequence, and then there's even an additional memory within that flashback in the flashback in the framing story. So think how many like weird inception levels you are when you're watching the story at that point. And I know for myself, I found that really thrilling, even though it is weird. It's like an experience unto itself.
I think it plays great at home. I was a little surprised about how well it played. I saw it at the Lincoln Center at its premiere. And then one night over the holidays, I was like, I want to watch Irishman, see how it plays in my living room. I started it after 9 o'clock, kind of figuring I'll going to take it in two halves, and just never left. It's just absolutely engrossing from beginning to end.
My take? It's what it is.
That's become, to me, the most handy sort of catchphrase, gif, whatever, meme. Astonished by how often that exact sentiment of it is what it is. It's like it's somehow, it actually oddly encapsulates the moment in a way that I don't think was ever intended.
Well, and it's like that phrase has been with us before, of course, but there's something about its recurrence this year in particular and in that movie that does seem to sum things up.
It helps that it comes from Pesci.
Yes. Who's great in the movie.
Who's so good.
Yes.
Look, The Irishman's going to be fine.
It's not going to win any Oscars.
Does it even have a chance in visual effects?
I mean, it has a chance in visual effects. It has a chance in film editing. Has a chance maybe in adapted screenplay. I don't think it's going to win any.
Because it's funny. I have to say, I actually kind of have come to really like the fact that there is this theatrical experience that, you know, a limited number of people were able to have. The idea that you can watch it all in one go on Netflix or chop it up into your own, you know, 2 to 3 night event. I think the phrase a few years ago was transmedia, that it was like this thing that had different ways you could approach it. I don't know that Martin Scorsese intended this, but I personally have come to like really like that. Jen, the movie is what it is, but it's kind of what you want it to be.
It comes back to this idea of what is success for a movie like that that otherwise might not have ever even existed. Mm-hmm. I feel like its existence is in itself must feel like a win for
totally
Scorsese. If it doesn't win an Oscar, okay. I would be much happier for other films winning that Oscar, but it's not because I think The Irishman is not cinema.
No. It's weird because I do love the movie. It's not the movie I'm most passionate about this season. I think that people do tend to sleep on Scorsese movies in their respective years. And he, you know, and famously, you know, I think the movie we're all thinking about and Glenn talks about in terms of being blanked 10 times is Gangs of New York, you know, which was kind of shocking at the time. And so I think that Scorsese is respected, revered. That kind of outsider status that he's always had sometimes comes back when his movies are actually up in front of the media spotlight, and people do think about how long they are, and, you know, is this repetitive, and it's just, you know, self-indulgent. I'm more passionate about other movies this year, too.
Not a failure if it doesn't win any Oscars.
For sure.
I mean, that's
it's not
right,
a 10 nominations is great. And we reach this kind of point in the season where there's got to be this clear demarcation, winner, loser. But they're all winners.
Maybe moving on now to Little Women. So this, of course, Greta Gerwig's adaptation of the Louisa May Alcott novel. In some ways, this movie has become an unexpected flashpoint of controversy, both when it was first coming out. There was this conversation of, oh, men don't want to see the movie, but then it's been kind of a commercial hit. And then the Academy nominations came out. Greta wasn't nominated for director, which felt like a bit of a snub, even though she was nominated for screenplay, and the movie was nominated for Best Picture, which made her, by the way, only the second woman to have ever directed two films nominated for Best Picture. So what do we make of Little Women? Jen, I know you have kind of your thoughts about Greta and Little Women. How do you feel about the movie?
I feel like I would have been more satisfied if she was also acknowledged for directing, along with the people who were acknowledged this year. I think it's great, actually, that so much attention has been given to some of the performances within this film, because they're all so good. But to see somebody like Florence Pugh, for example, be acknowledged is actually really exciting for me. She had three great movies this year that she was great in. Very, very different. One in which she played real-life WWE wrestler Paige. Another one in which she took mushrooms and taught us all some valuable lessons about relationships. And then Little Women, where she single-handedly redeemed one of the most loathed characters in literature. For me, I see those victories. That's cool. Would I have envisioned and hoped for a slightly different looking Best Director lineup? Yes.
I mean, I agree. She should have been nominated for Best Director. Her winning Best Adapted Screenplay would make me so happy, because I do think this is the best, smartest, most confidently radical Hollywood studio treatment of a literary adaptation I've seen in quite some time. And when that something is just such as beloved a touchstone as Little Women is, it's like that's actually pretty radical. People who don't like the movie or who have been saying, you know, why do we need another Little Women? I don't know how you could ask that question after watching this movie.
If you're asking it before. Seen it, right.
Yeah. And it makes me question, did you actually see the movie? Or do you, I mean, don't blame the movie for your own inattention. Because the movie, you know, and it's not just the way it shakes up chronology. Yes, it shakes up chronology in a way that adds just another dimension to a story that I think most people who go see the movie know very well. This is a movie, by the way, I think made for people who know the material well. I think it totally works. If you haven't, although maybe you're more likely to be confused by the back and forth. And here's the thing. I don't think the movie announces itself as this is the definitive Little Women. It kind of presents itself as a counter version, an alternate version. And it plays with Louisa May Alcott's own story herself and her difficulties getting published as a writer. When I first saw the movie, I wrestled with the structure myself. I was like, why is she doing this? This is really interesting. And I'm completely absorbed in this. But why? And then halfway through, I got it. And I was crying. I was like, when I watched the rest of the movie in tears. And then the next time I watched it, it's very, very rewatchable. I watched it with my family. I watched it, you know, and it just, I was almost like, I don't know how you could have told the story any other way. It's weird. It felt that intuitive to me.
Glenn, how do you feel about the performances? Saoirse Ronan, Laura Dern, Florence Pugh, Meryl Streep. I mean, it's a strong cast of performances. How do you feel about them?
I feel great. And I feel like Jen, ecstatic that Florence Pugh was nominated on Oscar morning, because that wasn't a given. We're all fans, it sounds like, in this room.
Well, I will say that I did not connect with 100% of Little Women. There are a lot of aspects of those characters that I did not find relatable, and in a way that I also found Lady Bird a bit hard for me to relate to. But that doesn't mean that I don't think it deserves to be in that conversation, which I do. It just, if anything, it reminds me of how many movies this year were not nominated for awards or for Oscars that I do think also deserve to be in this conversation, like Lulu Wang's The Farewell, for example. So many movies. And that's what I think of when we talk about Little Women in this context, is not just what flowers Little Women didn't get, but also what other films didn't even get that far.
I totally see how the tendency to put all our eggs for female directors into Greta Gerwig's basket, right? When she is, and it's unfortunate, even though I think she deserves it, I don't think she's the only female director, for example, like Lulu Wang.
So many, like, so many.
You know, so many, where do you start? Joanna Hogg, yeah. Claire Denis, just a few, you know, their movies are not even considered.
Claire Denis, can you imagine all of the Oscar votership watching High Life?
Yes, and they should be made to do
that. I would like that to have happened.
Over and over again.
You know?
It's a better movie than they deserve.
So I guess when we're saying we're all fans of Little Women, Jen's qualifying her ardor a bit. The Oscar nominations it got, I mean, no version of Little Women had ever been nominated for Best Picture. Here we are. I think if you had told Greta Gerwig a few months ago that this was going to be how it plays out and it's going to get Best Picture and Screenplay, nominations for Score, for Saoirse Ronan, for Florence Pugh, I think she would be very ecstatic. And she was on Oscar morning, and I don't think she was faking it.
I want to be sure to mention there was a really terrific piece written by Alison Wilmore in Vulture, specifically about the ending of the movie, which I know for some audiences has been kind of controversial in that it's the place where Greta departs from the source material the strongest. She kind of brings in elements of Louise May Alcott's own life, sort of fuses it with the story of the book. And this final sequence, Justin, you said you were in tears. I mean, I was so moved. There's a sequence in the movie towards the end where Jo March, played by Saoirse Ronan, is haggling with her publisher over the copyright of her book. There's something so moving and thrilling about it. And you never thought that like a copyright negotiation would be such an emotional linchpin in a movie like that. That just shows what a sort of exciting adaptation this is, where it really, it's not just like a musty book off the shelf. There's something really fresh and vibrant about
this. And it's bold because, I mean, I wrote a piece on the film, and she did not tell people at the studio that that was going to be the ending. Wow. She shot it independently. Amy Pascal, the producer, knew, but that was it. She didn't want any notes. She didn't want people to question her. She knew what she wanted to do, and that's great, bold filmmaking.
Maybe to move on to talking about 1917, Glenn, I will start by asking you, I don't know how to talk about this movie except as like an object of the awards race. The movie, because of when its release date was, the way it's come out, the fact that it's really kind of hit the award season like fast and hard, I can't think of this as like a movie apart from its awardsiness.
You can't think of, say, the tremendous achievement, say, Roger Deakins' cinematography, the sort of one-shot construction conceit of the film,
but
the
great, the great acting.
You know, I feel like I'm going to be the 1917 defender. I think that's what's interesting about award season is that, I mean, is it the movie I would vote for? No. Is it a movie that I necessarily even think I'll be considering or rewatching 5 years from now? No, which makes it probably the movie that's going to win Best Picture because that fits that definition. But it's a good movie. I watched it a second time at home with my son and it held up nice. I mean, it's got issues.
Wait,
it's
what not did perfect. Your son think?
He dug it.
Yeah?
Yeah. You know, the criticism of this movie, I think, is that it's just like a heightened Xbox. As my son
it
who
is
plays
like Call of Duty movie.
He's logged a few minutes.
Did he
back
see
in
that,
the day.
That relationship as well? Did he notice that kind of parallel?
My son's 17, so he's at a phase where he doesn't really he's a 17-year-old boy. He's not going to give me paragraphs of reaction. He's going to, it's good, Dad. That was good.
I don't know if I'm a defender, but I have been trying to, I think, combat the impulse to, you know, this is what award season does to us. We hate perfectly good movies just because they're the front runner. And that's not, you know, and I don't
or
like
we
that.
Or we compare them.
We compare. And that's okay because this is about putting movies in conversation with each other. And I like that. And that's part of the discourse. I've been trying to fight that with 1917 because I did like this movie more than I expected to, maybe even more than I want to be honest, because it
Same
does
here.
Look like, yeah, it looks like stodgy conservative, and it's not. It is and it isn't. I do think that the technical virtuosity of the movie is of a kind that it is a little too easy to laud as greatness, and I think that Mendes is getting a bit of a free pass for working with a really great DP in Roger Deakins, and I do think one-take, long-take movies are becoming, you know, and look, these techniques are as old as Hollywood itself.
Justin, are you calling it a gimmick?
I use that word in my Fresh Air review, I think it's a gimmick. I think it's, you could also call it a conceit, mm-hmm. a formal conceit. I think that's fair. Gimmicks are not bad. I think, you know, gimmickry, I think, is part of movie making.
But it's when there's actually like emotion and compelling story and characters beneath that gimmick that a film can transcend.
Completely.
And
1917 has that.
It does have that.
And arguably.
I think the performances are the real secret weapon of the movie. Mm. They're better than you is, and they're actually, and they're, they do provide, I think mm-hmm. Dean Charles Chapman and George MacKay mm-hmm. are great. I have questions about, does this conceit actually serve the content of the movie? I think sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And there are times that play more Call of Duty-ish than others.
What I find interesting about the award-specific conversation around 1917 is, at least in the lead-up to the weekend when 1917 won the PGA Award, which is largely thought to be a major indicator, right, of Oscars. It makes total sense, though, that producers would vote for the most difficult-looking production, right? So, like, regardless of any other sort of cinematic elements one might vote by, to me, that made total sense. And I don't necessarily feel like that's an indicator. I don't know what you would think, Glenn, of how other bodies would vote, but what do you think?
I think it's winning Best Picture.
Tell us why.
Voters, Academy members, rank their movies. Rank these 9 Best Picture candidates. What ends up happening in this ranking, in the taking away of piles of the least liked movies, the, you know, what happens is that the Oscar goes to a movie that's, I put it as the least disliked, the movie people are most okay with.
So you're saying it's not a passion vote?
Yeah, I mean, passion vote.
Or it can be, but passion plus consensus, right?
Yeah, you know? I mean, occasionally, and believe me, I'm watching the SAG Awards Sunday night, and I'm seeing 2 standing ovations for Parasite, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and I'm standing for Parasite.
Mm-hmm. I was there, and it was shocking
yes.
and beautiful, because, well, shocking because it was so unexpected, but also beautiful because of that. So many people, I think, wrote off the Screen Actors Guild voters as being like actors who like to vote for other actors or like vote for stories about themselves, sort of presume a level of vanity and ego into that particular award. And then when the Parasite cast came on stage at the beginning of the show, they got a standing ovation from all the famouses in the room. Which is great.
And I think that was both a recognition of the brilliance of Parasite and how much people loved that movie. And I think that the sight of Asian actors taking the stage in Hollywood is such a rarity. This was still felt so unprecedented, you know, that outpouring of emotion was just completely authentic.
And now one of the things I always really regret most as sort of award season marches along is the way that it sort of narrows down the movies that we're able to talk about, like, you know, you only really at this point talk about the nominated films. And so there's just fewer and fewer like titles to pick from, which Glenn, I think, is why you sort of end up in this weird like movie coma in a way. So I want to take a minute, open the floor back up, maybe like a last chance saloon here. What are some titles that maybe you all would still hope that people, whether they're still in the conversation or not, would still be paying attention to? Jen, I know you had a title you were excited to be talking about.
Oh, well, in terms of Oscar-nominated movies that aren't some of the big razzle-dazzle flashy categories, there's a short film called Hair Love, which was actually nominated for Best Animated Short. It's very simple, very actually emotionally compelling story with a little dialogue. And it's about a father having to learn how to do his daughter's hair. And specifically, it is about African-American characters. And it's so beautiful. I was really happy to see it nominated. It's one that you can view online right now on YouTube. It's only like 6 minutes or something. So that's one that I feel like this year, as we remind people that there are more than, you know, like the main categories of the Oscars, look at some of the other titles in the other categories and give them a watch before the Oscars.
And Justin, what about you?
Continuing Jen's recommendation for animation, and I love Hair Love as well, I want to recommend the not Oscar-nominated but Oscar-shortlisted animated film Mirona's Fantastic Tale, which I believe is a French-Romanian co-production and possibly another country as well. The director is Romanian, Anca Damian. This movie, which I saw as part of the Animation is Film jury this past year, just completely snuck up on me. It's about a dog. It's a beautiful dog movie. I don't want to say it's like the dog movie to end all dog movies, but it's interesting because it's really, you think it's going to be cutesy, sentimental, but it's really, I think it's the Romanian part of it that keeps it from being so sentimental. It's got this real shot of vinegar to it. The animation is so inventive and gorgeous. I also really want to quickly shout out Zhao Tao in Ashes Purest White, Jia Zhangke's wonderful movie, one of the best this year. And she placed runner-up at the National Society of Film Critics for Best Actress, right behind Mary Kay Place for Diane. And I think if more people had seen the movie, maybe. But, you know, she's Jia Zhangke's longtime collaborator, and she just gets better and better. Ashes Pierce White, it's a great gangster movie. Everyone should see it.
I'm going to second my good friend Jennifer Aniston, who gave a shout out to the Sandman, Adam Sandler, on stage at the SAG Awards. And I was thinking, yeah, thank you, Jen. For one last shout out for, to me, what was the great acting performance by Adam Sandler, Uncut Gems. I think it was a little too crazy for a lot of people. It seemed to leave people in kind of a bad state, which I thought was great.
Oh, yeah.
I wish Adam Sandler was at the Oscars wearing cargo shorts and a t-shirt.
Adam, when he did not get nominated for an Oscar, he tweeted out that it was too bad that Sandman had not gotten a nomination, but that he was happy that Sandman no longer had to wear suits.
Right. I kind of feel like if he had gone to the Oscars, he would have worn one of those tuxedo t-shirts, and that would have been pretty awesome.
I'm going to take just one quick moment to mention Elizabeth Moss, the actress who stars in the movie Her Smell, which was one of my favorites of last year, and it's something of like a stylistic cousin in a way to Uncut Gems. Her Smell is currently on HBO, and I still am shocked every time I turn on my television. And if that movie, when I see that it's going to be on HBO, or especially if I just accidentally stumble across it, that is like the last movie you think of as like an afternoon cable picture. And I don't know what it says about the state of distribution in the country that like a movie like that ends up on, you know, a major cable conglomerate. But I just think it's a wonderful, wonderful surprise every time I stumble across it.
Also has a great cover of Heaven by Bryan Adams.
Yes, it does. Mm.
And with that, we'll wrap up this conversation about some of these Oscar movies that we haven't had a chance to talk about previously. There's only really a couple weeks left to this year's great race. And so, Jen Yamato, Justin Chang, Glenn Whip, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mark.
That's it for this week's show. Thanks to our producer, Paige Heimson, and our audio engineer, Mike Heflin. Subscribe to The Real on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star review. You can also visit us at latimes.com/The Real.